Episode 19 and 20 of Talking Culture will act as an introduction to the Synthetic Sacred Programme, supported by the Goethe Institute London and curated by Lucy Rose Sollett, an experienced researcher and cultural programmer who specialises in merging art, technology and ecosystemic change. Before we jump into our discussion with our three guests today, Lucy is going to tell us a bit more about what Synthetic Sacred is.
So the Synthetic Sacred is a new action research initiative exploring pathways for ecological restoration amidst hybridity. The combination of synthetic and sacred might seem a little bit jarring in an ecological context, but our ecologies are increasingly synthetic. So just to illustrate, in 2020, the weight of human-made mass surpassed that of all global living mass. So how do we make sense of this? In contrast to the idea of a pristine version of nature, which tends to dominate cultural and environmental discourse, the Synthetic Sacred recognises the existence of synthetic and natural ecologies. Often, synthetic ecologies are highly destructive and toxic. To use a well-known example, plastic is now found in human placentas and in the guts of creatures living deep in the ocean. And among other things, microplastics are associated with a decrease in fertility for all animals, including humans. Of course, though, synthetic creations, they're not all bad. For example, biomaterials can be used to create non-toxic objects and buildings, while biobots could help clean the oceans. But while the majority of hybrid creations are driven by capitalist colonialist logics of extraction and exploitation, they are more likely to continue the widespread natural destruction that we see today. Given this, the notion of the synthetic sacred is both a provocation and an attempt to forge sustainable narratives and practices. Weaving together post-human, new materialist and indigenous knowledge systems, the synthetic sacred explores sacred experience as a means to heal fractured relations with nature. I offer the notion of the synthetic sacred as a framework with which to guide and detoxify our synthetic creations, ensuring that all ecologies flourish. So the two episodes I've curated for the Talking Culture podcast explore these ideas by looking at some of our most high-tech creations, in particular biodigital convergence and the emergence of synthetic life. We ask what future present these innovations, from biological robots to drone-controlled dragonflies, are ushering in. And who gets to decide? Together we explore the potential for synthetic life to be part of ecological restoration and flourishing.
You're listening to Talking Culture, a Futures podcast. Through fascinating interviews with thinkers and doers in the arts and culture sector, this show investigates how creative fields are emerging from the tumultuous present into the future. From the Goethe Institute London, this is a podcast about the critical role that arts and culture have in our societies. I'm your producer and host, Lucy Rowan. As the curator of this episode, Lucy Rose Sollett has selected the following three guests to bring different perspectives to the conversation today. The first of our three guests today is Mike Levin, Professor of Biology at Tufts University. Mike's work spans from fundamental conceptual frameworks to applications in birth defects, regeneration and cancer. The second is Agnieszka Kurant, an award-winning conceptual artist investigating collective and non-human intelligence and the exploitations present in digital surveillance capitalism. She has had solo exhibitions at the Hanover Kunstverein and the Sculpture Center, to name a few. After receiving his PhD in genetics from the University of Cambridge, Johannes Vogel worked at the Natural History Museum in London. In 2012, he took up his position as the Director General of the Natural History Museum in Berlin. He is also a Professor of Biodiversity and Science Dialogue at Humboldt Universität in Berlin. The spectrum of possible futures that biodigital convergence opens up is vast, but could be very narrow if led by the interests of industry alone. For this episode, we will consider the possibilities and ask, what becomes of nature when life is synthetic? Who or what controls life when nature is bionic? And can biotech ever be part of ecological restoration? Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Talking Culture podcast. I'd like to start today's episode by thanking our three guests, Mike, Agnieszka and Johannes. I'm really looking forward to having you on the podcast today, and I'm sure our conversation is going to be very riveting. So for the first question, I'm going to come to you, Mike. It might be easy to assume that synthetic biology is a niche area that doesn't affect our lives. Could you briefly paint a picture for us of just how much is going on in this field and how we will be directly impacted by this?
I view this as a branch of the field of diverse intelligence, which is the ability to learn to recognize and optimally relate to various degrees and kinds of minds and really unfamiliar embodiments. And I see this synthetic biology as not just a kind of bioengineering, but as really importing tools from behavioral and cognitive science to collaborate with the medium. It's very much taking advantage of the natural competencies of the agential medium of life. And so I think the life is going to be altered. All of our experiences are going to be altered in several primary ways. First of all, there will be the early applications will be very practical things. So there will be biobots that help heal the body. There will be technologies for regenerating missing and aged and degenerative organs. There will be all kinds of biomedical kinds of applications. There will be environmental applications and so on. But I think more fundamentally, what's going to happen, and it's, I don't think it's going to take very long, the children and then the people of the future are going to be very different from us. It's going to be very hard for them to imagine living in a house where nothing else speaks, to be the only intelligence among a desert of passive materials. This is the coming consilience of AI, of synthetic morphology, of diverse intelligence more broadly, is going to mean that we are surrounded by all kinds of cognitive beings that are very different from anything we're used to. They do not share the tree of life with us, and yet they have interesting aspects of cognition. I think in the future, the capacity to go beyond this notion of only loving our own kind, of being able to extend compassion and optimal relationships with beings that are very different than us, is going to be exploding in a way that we can hardly realize. And finally, conceptually, all of our old dichotomies, our categories of organisms, machines, real, synthetic, all of these terms are going to sound like terms of various different kinds of witches sound to us now. I mean, these are all things that are just, they're going to be dissolved in favor of much more powerful categories.
Agnieszka, as an artist, you've been exploring these developments in your own work and posing really important questions around it. So thinking about the role that art and culture can play, why is it important to consider these developments?
So on the one hand, we are starting to realize that the paradigm of individualism, which was the basis of a lot of creativity and thinking about creativity for the past 500 years, is definitely coming to an end, and that this was to some degree definitely a blind alley. I mean, individualism has brought us as a civilization, as a species to on the verge of even our own extinction, but extinction of many other species, profound inequality, societal collapse, colonization and climate change and so on. So thinking about other forms of how systems work and how most important things in the world are created through collective intelligence and through these complex systems can also make us think differently about creativity. Because if we realize that everything in the world is a product of a multitude, of a collective intelligence, whether mineral formations or organisms or ecosystems or societies, then we also have to rethink art and culture and stop thinking about individual creators, but think about the fact that each one of us is a biome. Our organisms carry viruses, bacteria, fungi, and they impact our mental states. They impact our moods, our decisions. And so also, of course, it has to have an impact on our creativity. And we have to start thinking that none of the creative forms that were created, that were produced in human societies, was a product of a single individual. They always were in a dialogue with others or in a dialogue with the past, sometimes in the dialogue with the future. And so the whole idea of individual single creator artist was created part of actually exploitation of the very networked, complex creative process. I am thinking in my work about embracing this fact that there is no such thing as individual intelligence, and therefore there is no such thing as individual creativity. Thinking about an individual human as, you know, with all the microbiome, for example, that we carry, but also with all the dialogues we have with other humans. So what kind of impact does it have for thinking about creativity, of course, consciousness as well, and how maybe in the future, when we finally embrace this fact that individualism was really a blind alley and a wrong idea, we're going to think about creativity in a different way and how forms can be produced by complex systems of not only humans, but also non-humans, possibly also machines, which we also can observe already today.
Agnieszka did a great job there at introducing this cross-disciplinary perspective and showing how these two worlds of science and art are really merging more and more. So a question to all three of you, what can the fields of science and art offer or learn from one another? Johannes, maybe you'd like to go first.
First of all, let's talk about what both share. They both prize creativity and ingenuity, and they allow individuals or research groups to explore the world as they want to see it and try to make sense out of processes, patterns, and so on and so forth. The difference, however, is that science acts under a strict conduct. We have to follow rules in order to be recognized by our peers and rewarded by our peers through peer recognition, such as acceptance in publications we do or acceptance in grant proposals we write and want to use to expand our work. Artists have a much broader license to operate. Nothing will be considered outside of the mainstream. In science, there is that form of self-censorship, what is accepted as a scientific quest and what isn't. So, in a way, that offers the opportunity, in my opinion, for fruitful exchange between these two worlds, where the common currency is creativity and exploring the unknown, but one in a structured system, the other with the freedom of imagination and mind. And I think both might benefit from working closer together, as we've experimented with now very, very successfully in the last 12 years here at the Museum für Naturkunde in Berlin.
So exactly as Johannes explained, there are a lot of challenges today. I think that we're living in times where the acceleration of technological progress, both in the fields of AI and biotech, has gained such a pace that it's very difficult to catch up with it, with our ethics, with our policies. And the fields of science is not always sufficient to provide such a broad spectrum of answers. We don't have enough time to develop these answers if we just stuck to this prescribed methodologies, because things have to be invented as we go, sometimes in a very impromptu manner. There is this kind of solipsism of science that sometimes takes a very long time for certain theories and then policies to be developed. Meanwhile, art and culture are based on experimentation, and they are more open to risk and to failure, and in fact embrace both risk and failure in the practice. It's kind of a basis of a lot of creativity, using failure and randomness and trial and error. So this different methodology, I think, is very important. And this idea of serendipity and conscious erring, which I think, talking to a lot of scientists that I've been in a dialogue with, I realized that even the question of funding in science is problematic, because if somebody wants to discover something completely different and unknown that they are not really even quite sure what it's going to be, they just kind of vaguely know where to dig. It's technically impossible from the point of view of funding, because you have everything has to be teleological and you have to exactly describe what you're looking for. But when you think about how any discovery happens in any field, that a lot of them happen by accident. Think about, penicillin or x-rays or many other scientific discoveries. People were looking for something else and then stumbled accidentally on something else that became a big discovery. This is actually quite inspiring for me, because I think that this is the kind of different type of research that art does, that applies different methodology and is open to the black swan.
I think that there's an important aspect of the scientific process that we rarely talk about, which is what we teach our students is usually this cycle where you have a number of hypotheses, and then what you're supposed to do is come up with experiments that distinguish between them so that you can rule out or disprove the ones that are incorrect. So we have this idea of using experiment to filter through the possible ideas, and whatever is left, that's, you know, that's what you have. And so we teach that. We teach strong inference. We teach rigorous hypothesis making. We teach that you cannot prove hypotheses. You can only disprove them, and so on. We teach all this stuff. Fundamentally, that leaves a very large gap, which is where do the good hypotheses come from in the first place? So the strategy of being able to come up with hypotheses that are interesting, that are fruitful, that take the research in a new direction, in a positive development of the field, that is not an algorithmic process. We don't teach it because I'm not aware of any specific turn the crank methodology that will get you there. We do have an algorithm for disproving hypotheses, and that works quite well, and we teach it to all our students. But the first part, that's the creative part, and I think that's very much, I mean, I'm not an artist, but I tend to think that this is very much related to what artists do, because that one is not scripted and it's not algorithmic, and you are free to draw your inspiration from anywhere and to think. Really, no one can turn off the way you think with a lack of funding. They can turn off the experiments, but they can't control how you think. And so that part is the artistic part to me, is to be completely free and unconstrained in coming up with the ideas. And then the other half of the process takes over, where of course you have to test them and so on.
Agnieszka, in recent years, many artists and cultural theorists have been challenging and expanding traditional or Western categories of intelligence, from the human to a multi-species understanding. Likewise, you often experiment with creating or perhaps highlighting collective intelligence and emphasize the need to abandon any notion of individualism. But you also take it further by creating possible minds, not just across species, but also the internet, artificial intelligence, and so on. Could you give our listeners some examples of how you're exploring this in your art? For example, I can think of your exhibition on computables at Kunstverein Hanover.
So the project that I have been developing for many years now is AAI, which stands for Artificial Intelligence. It's a series of sculptures that I have outsourced or crowdsourced to termite colonies. I worked with biologists from the University of Florida, in particular with Dr. Paul Bardunias, who is an entomologist. We worked with colonies of termites because I realized that termites are almost blind. They cannot perceive color, for example. We have supplied termites with alternative building materials. And as you know, termites build their houses, they build their termite mounds. These termite mounds resemble pyramids or temples. They are very kind of unique forms in nature, and they can also survive for up to 100 years. I was interested in how we can compare nature as working as an algorithm in deep time with the kind of optimization that happens with artificial intelligence. But in this case, in nature, it happens collectively through a colony of termites. And a similar process is now currently done with artificial intelligence, with an algorithm optimizing forms. Engineering developments are done this way. But interestingly enough, we can see also artificial intelligence as a form of exploitation of distributed collective intelligence of all the internet users, anybody who puts any content online, which corporations such as Google or Meta are exploiting to make these systems of artificial intelligence better, exploring our digital footprints and input. So inspired by this, I realized that a society of termites can be used to produce a sculptural form. And this was a way of me proposing an alternative way of making artworks that are not made by me nor by any single person, but that they emerge in a completely uncontrolled way out of this society that builds them. And I realized that because termites don't see exactly what they are building their these forms out of, so we supplied them with alternative building materials using a very vividly colored sand, gold, and broken crystals. And they built this fantastically colored, very artificially looking forms of termite mounds that are, on the other hand, perfectly natural because they are built by termite societies. And each sculpture is a product of a different colony. And I was particularly inspired by the fact that entomologists look at different termite colonies and they see how different collective minds or collective personalities emerge even within the same species. Two different colonies can kind of emerge as very intelligent very differently, or having different personality traits collectively. And we can also see it in the shapes of these termite mounds. And I basically highlighted this by creating this very artificially looking sculptures hovering exactly between nature and culture. And more recently, I developed a project called Alien Internet, which is inspired by, two phenomena. One is the Wood Wide Web, which is a network between fungi and roots created in forests between trees that communicate and exchange information about their environment. And on the other hand, the phenomenon of animal internet, which is the ways in which many wildlife ecosystems are already being penetrated by technologies and how different scientific institutes, but also individual people are connecting with wildlife through various means, cameras installed in the wild and AI parsing of different data about animals based on also neurotransmitters that are installed on animals' bodies and drones. Many other forms that essentially are starting to create a system of surveillance of wildlife, which of course is on the one hand very interesting and great. Also in a way how they predict certain phenomena such as tsunamis, earthquakes, or floods. Very interesting, like looking at behavior of animals, we can anticipate these events sometimes better than using our technological devices. So for me, in terms of looking and thinking about different cosmologies that are non-human cosmologies in a way, was interesting. Of course, the flip side of it is that it's increasing surveillance of wildlife and it's penetrating and colonizing these last pockets of wilderness. So it's not necessarily always good.
I think what's really interesting there, Agnieszka, is that you illuminated what nature and life can already offer us as a basis to then create other life forms, not necessarily creating life forms from scratch when we think about synthetic biology. And when you were talking about that, Agnieszka, I started thinking about Mike's TED Talk, which I really enjoyed. It's fascinating, the developments that you're making at the moment using tadpoles as a basis. And I will add the link onto the website page if anyone's interested in seeing that themselves. So Mike, thinking about the novel life forms that you've created, such as Xenobots and now Amphrobots. Firstly, what are these for people who have no idea? And can you tell us a bit more about how this shapes your understanding of intelligence and life more broadly?
Well, I suppose the first thing to do is to talk about what is the definition of intelligence. And there are many potential definitions, but what I really like is William James's emphasis on the ability to reach the same goal by different means. So this is a very cybernetic definition. It doesn't talk about brains. It doesn't talk about whether you're evolved or engineered. It focuses on some degree of competency to operate in a problem space, to reach your goals, and to have multiple paths of getting there despite various kinds of perturbations, barriers, and so on. One of the things that we're very interested in is if you think about the whole spectrum of cognition all the way from passive matter, which has basically just the capacity to minimize, let's say, free energy and things like that, all the way through different categories of homeostats, simple devices that can pursue specific set points, and then learning agents. Which can do associative learning or other kinds of memory, and all the way to complex metacognitive beings like us. If you look at that whole spectrum, one of the things that I think is really important to notice is that you cannot have feelings or philosophical preconceptions about where things fit on that spectrum. You have to do experiments. And this is because we are, I think, not good at guessing the intelligence and the competence of unconventional systems. All of our sense organs, all of our evolutionary experience means that we're okay at recognizing intelligence and medium-sized objects moving at medium speeds in three-dimensional space. But I think we are actually surrounded by really fascinating examples of intelligence. And if we had the ability to, for example, directly sense your own blood chemistry, I think you would have no problem visualizing your liver and your kidneys as an intelligent being that navigates physiological space and deals with all kinds of problems and so on. So what we work on is this ability to develop a framework, and I call it TAME. It stands for Technological Approach to Mind Everywhere. And the idea is to develop a set of practical tools and principled approaches to actually ask the question for any kind of system, where does it fit? So that's not the kind of animism where you assume that the universe is intelligent and that there's a spirit behind every rock, nor the kind of materialism that we have where you actually assume that all of these things are dumb and have no intelligence, but principled approaches to try and get it correct, get the right answer for any given system. One can ask for cells and tissues, for example, in this process of going from being an unfertilized oocyte to being a human or some other animal. One can ask in that process, the cells and tissues, where do they fit? What plasticity do they have? Do they have goal-directed behavior? Can they learn? How much intelligence is actually in that process? And so my group is asking all those questions in particular because they're critical for regenerative medicine, but also for understanding evolution. And one of the things you can do when you ask those questions is you can place various types of biologicals, might be cells, tissues, or even molecular networks in novel circumstances and ask how much plasticity do they have? How much problem-solving capacity? And one of the things we found, so you referred to our work in biobots, which is one branch of that effort. What we found out is that if you liberate cells from the rest of the body, you find out that they actually, in novel circumstances, they have capacities to do some very interesting things that we normally do not see under default development. Reliability of development, the fact that acorns always make oak trees and frog eggs make frogs, lulls us into this false sense of this machine-like emergence that, okay, well, it has to be this way. This is what it makes. And actually, that's not the case at all. And so we found that, for example, skin cells from a frog or tracheal epithelial cells from adult human patients have the ability to self-assemble into these self-motile little biobots that run around and they do interesting things. One of the things that xenobots can do is they make copies of themselves from other loose cells that they find in their environment. So they sort of compact them together into little balls that then mature into the next generation of xenobots. The anthrobots have different abilities. They, for example, can heal neural wounds. You know, we would have never had any idea that your tracheal cells sitting there peacefully for decades, given the opportunity, can actually run around and heal other parts of the body. In all of these cases, we're asking questions about plasticity. We're asking questions about what is possible in the software of life, aside from the standard outcomes that we normally see. This is very much a collaboration. I don't believe that we make these bots. Okay, we do not make these bots. We collaborate with the competencies of cells to try to coax them into different ways of being. And they do a lot of the heavy lifting, which is good for us, for regenerative medicine and so on. They do a lot of the hard work. And so this is just the beginning of that field, but that's what it's telling us. For the whole field of diverse intelligence, the ability to make these, to facilitate the self-assembly of these novel beings with novel behaviors and novel gene expression patterns and novel physiology is the next best thing to finding alien life. You know, we haven't found any alien life yet, but here we are able to make something that has never been selected for in the history of evolution, right? So there's never been pressure to be a good xenobot. There's never been selective pressure to be a good anthrobot. And yet they're able to do these amazing things. Where do those shapes come from? Can we learn to detect, predict, and tame, for all practical purposes, these inherent competencies of this medium?
Johannes, you too come from a genetics background, and the work that you've done for the Natural History Museum in Berlin and previously in London has been so pivotal in shaping the way we think about the future of natural history and evolution. At a time where biodiversity extinction is such a pressing issue, why is it important for us to be thinking beyond the human?
I'm sure I'm not going to give the right answer because there's so many. First of all, I think we have to consider that it is highly unlikely that humans will stop life on Earth. Whatever horrible things we do to this planet, we are probably mainly going to do it to ourselves. We are not going to do it to life. And as, for example, Mike has explained, the plasticity of life, the tenacity, the enormous adaptability of life is way, way beyond our reach. There are speculations or even evidence that there's microbial life kilometers below the ocean floor, and so on and so forth. There are thermic vents on Earth. Even if you were to create a snowball Earth through a nuclear winter, the thermic vents would certainly continue spew out chemical energy and life would continue living off it. In my opinion, the whole issue about the extinction crisis has to be an argument about ourselves. What type of life do we consider as being a good life? And how are we adjusting our behavior, our consumption patterns, and perhaps our mental state, our cultures? How are we adapting those to be able to survive and have a future with all the other species we share this planet with? Yuval Harari has come up with, in my opinion, a very nice phrase, and that is, what is human's superpower? And he concludes that it is storytelling, and I would very much agree with it. One of the stories that we are getting completely wrong is that we and nature, so humans and nature, are separate things. The right story is that we are dependent on nature in everything we do, we consume, we use to make a living, from the air we breathe to the water we drink to the energy we need. We need a different story. That's basically what my point to this would be. And interesting is that both Agnieszka and Mike are already telling different type of stories from their perspective. And we need a lot more of that, because the herd instinct we are all following through our upbringing, through the media, and so on and so forth, is, one would easily argue, when you look at it from an evolutionary biologist's point of view, is the wrong path.
Could I just add something small to that? I 100% agree that storytelling is a key feature of life, but I want to give this perspective that I think actually it is not a fundamentally human superpower. I think it is baked into the very earliest stages of life, because being able to tell a story, aka having a compressed model, a generalization of what the world around you is like, what you are like, is an essential feature to surviving in the world. The very earliest organisms, the most primitive early organisms, given that they are under constraint of energy, they're under constraint of time, if they try to tell an accurate representation of what was going on in the world, meaning they tried to track all the microstates where all the different chemicals and ions are going, they wouldn't make it to pass the first few seconds, right? You would be eaten in no time. The Placian demon version of describing the world is not a strategy that works in the real world. And so I think from the earliest moments of life, having to sustain yourself in a complex world, you are already required to be able to tell stories about yourself and what you're capable of and what senses and effectors you have and what the world around you is like, make models so that you can have expectations, so that you can key in on fluctuations and things that are regular in your environment and be surprised. You know, we have a project in the lab studying surprise in algae, and believe it or not, algae can be surprised, and that's because they have expectations. And this active inference framework works all the way down to the bottom. And so I think storytelling is truly fundamental to what it is to be a cognitive agent, and I think it's baked into us from the very earliest stages of life.
If I can also briefly add to this question of storytelling. So in one of my recent works entitled Adjacent Possible, that makes a reference to a lot of research of Stuart Kaufman, for example, I was thinking about other possible forms of life that evolution hasn't explored yet, or we haven't explored yet. And I was thinking about similar questions that can be asked in terms of our civilizations and cultures. In that project, I was inspired by how non-human living organisms such as cyanobacteria and fungi helped us to preserve certain information and history of culture of humans. I got interested in paintings, rock art, that are called Guion or Bradshaw paintings, that survived almost 80,000 years in Australia, just because the pigments that were used by the early humans that created this rock art were over time completely replaced by bacteria, cyanobacteria and fungi. And so actually non-humans helped us to preserve this very early forms of culture to this day. I think that there are a lot of paradoxical and interesting situations in which we even can take advantage of this non-human life forms and how things are mixing together, this kind of entanglement of all these realms. Johannes was talking about the thermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, and one of these phenomena really inspired me. So astrobiologists have been experimenting recently looking for other extraterrestrial life forms. They are looking at so-called chemical gardens, and I've experimented with them a lot in my work. On the one hand, chemical gardens, they are these forms that are growing that were found as fossils very often throughout the history of geology. And many scientists thought that they were actually life forms because they looked like fossilized plants. But in reality, they are just crystals that grew in this kind of plant forms. They grow as a result of mix of various metal salts at the bottom of the oceans in the vicinity of this thermal vents that produces like incredible colors and incredible forms, as if the plant forms were kind of hardwired somewhere in matter. And it's kind of paradoxical and still not completely understood, but that's what like is now driving a lot of like questions in astrobiology research. But for me, it was interesting because exactly the same metals, the extraction of the same metals that create these quasi-life forms, they are currently being extracted in order to be used in computers. And they are actually at the same time causing the death of ecosystems, while it's suspected that the same metals were actually causing the beginning of life. They were in this primordial soup. So this idea of like how various inorganic substances are continuously reorganized into various unstable forms, both can kill life and produce new life, they are really circulating between digital and geological and biological, and there is a continuity. And as Johannes said, I mean, this is all combined. There are no divisions. It's a continuity between these realms, and it's full of paradoxes.
Just very briefly to that one, we've lately conducted a study in cultural institutions and at the Natural History Museum to see whether we can find traces of curators and visitors to the collections on the surface of the objects. And yes, like in Australia, where microbes preserve art. Here, art preserves microbes and bits of curator and visitor. It's always a matter of perspective, how you look at things. And that is, I think, where science can learn from art, that you can change perspectives and have to change perspectives in order actually to come up with what Mike said, the dearth of good new hypotheses.
Johannes, it's really funny that you touched on this experiment that you're doing at the Natural History Museum and looking at the visitors and how they're impacting or preserving, or their microorganisms are being preserved within the artworks. It reminded me of when we had Gala Porras Kim on the show for our Lives of Objects episode, and she'd created an artwork out of an instance of Exploration Comes a Perennial Showing, whereby she used the mold from a decaying mummy to create an artwork. And I think this really demonstrates the kind of creative possibilities and boundary breaking that's going on at the moment in the culture sector when we think about cultural heritage objects and how we preserve and display them. Johannes, Michael has said that xenobots are the first organism whose evolution has taken place not in the Earth's biosphere, but on a computer. What future natural history is currently being created today? And will we be seeing that anytime soon in the Natural History Museum in Berlin?
First of all, while I like and respect what Mike does, life that is on Earth, I would say, is not outside of the Earth's biosphere. It has been created with the blueprint that this one life that inhabits this planet is formed. While computers manipulate life, and or even genetic techniques like CRISPR-Cas and so on and so forth, or even radiation can create new forms and new stuff, I would argue it's still within the life's biosphere. Now, can you see stuff in natural history museums? That is a very, very good question. We've looked into it, whether or not we should start creating synthetic life. It is quite a challenging process. First of all, there's not really that much to see. So if, like any decent natural history museum, you have 10, 20-meter dinosaur skeletons to enthuse your visitors with, a xenobot, however fascinated I am by it, might not have the same pull on four-year-olds. But that's a matter of taste. The closest we come to it is that together with the Paris Natural History Museum, we are now going to build facilities for Earth return samples. And they will be high security things, because I think we all know the Andromeda story of Michael Crichton. We have to work with safety aspects, and whatever other life might be out there or we might create, at this moment, I would urge caution before I would unleash it on the public. There are safety aspects and also the aspect that through artistic interpretation or through scientific endeavor and imagination like Mike does it, these things can become part of the public imagination. The way how natural history museums work, especially mine, that is very, very successful focusing on the analog, it's not a go yet. Whether or not we put it into our storage is a completely different issue. And as I said, we will build high security facilities for space return samples, where we certainly need that level of security.
Reflecting on these developments that are being done in the field at the moment and the possibilities of emerging technologies and science, whilst it can all seem very exciting, I think it's important to really drum home those ethical considerations. From one perspective, it can be argued that these emerging technologies and science are allowing us to play God and design future life forms. So, Mike, this question's for you. Who gets to play that role and under what terms?
I think in order to answer that question, we have to define two terms. We have to define play and we have to define God. The first one is easier. I'm going to say that play is activity that takes place without a specific purpose in mind. From that perspective, I will tell you that evolution, as well as humans with our limited understanding, we've already been doing this for a very long time. So it is not the case that there is pre-planned optimum that is here and it's on us not to screw it up. I don't think this is true at all. I think the baseline case is actually extremely problematic for many life forms on Earth, in the sense of whatever you think about God, there are no gods in the sense that you can reliably depend on one to solve problems. Okay, that much is clear. I think the lesson of pediatric oncology is that there really is no such thing. That is clear. Whatever else you think of God, we do not have one that we can actually rely on to solve problems.
Let me just briefly interject. I've lately heard that somebody has counted how many gods there has evidence of in human civilization, and there are about 4,000 or something like that. So even the concept of God is quite transient, whether or not they exist.
And that's fine, and you can have 4,000 or however many you want, but the one thing that we do not have is one that can be counted on to solve our problems. This means that there really is no option that maps onto some sort of respectful, let a benevolent God sort it out. There is no such option. What there is some kind of a spectrum that involves this really what I consider to be a kind of a cowardly moral lapse to avoid doing the hard work to define what our values are and how we are going to assist the myriads of sentient beings who have massively unacceptable existence at the moment. The medical suffering out there is immense. The obvious environmental problems are immense. These things are not going to solve themselves. They're not going to be solved by evolution, which basically just tries to maximize a copy number. It doesn't optimize for any of the things that we value. It doesn't optimize for intelligence. It doesn't optimize for happiness. None of those things. So I think that none of us are playing God in the sense that we have been up until now, which is doing things without the comprehension of what's going to happen. We now have to do the hard work. We actually have to do the hard work of taking on the responsibility of improving the lived experience of other beings. We cannot rely on the vagaries of random mutation and selection to optimize any of the things that we have here. We now have to do the hard work of asking, what do we value? What do we optimize? And how are we going to get there?
I sometimes feel a little bit overwhelmed at the rate of technological advancements. Agnieszka, in particular, you've commented as well how evolution is accelerating faster than we can even process. Things are moving so fast that we don't even have the time to stop and ask important ethical questions. And I know that in all three of your work, this is something that's taken very seriously. In the field of science and every emerging technology that forms out of it, it's vital to be considering these questions of who's in control of it and what their intentions are. But going beyond the human aspect of it, Johannes, what could be the unintended consequences of adding synthetic organisms with their own agency into the biosphere?
We've done that already. Agriculture is the best example. We are not eating anything natural. We are only eating synthetic. We even dress ourselves in synthetic. What the consequences of altering life, whether through breeding, plant breeding, animal breeding, genetic manipulation, or even creating life in a computer is, it's very, very difficult to recall. So any technical stuff we do, at the moment we can recall. So we are now communicating here with computers and iPhones. You can throw them all in one big trash. They are not replicating. So anything technological that we've built, including atomic power plants, they can be sealed off, put away, and it's a matter of time until their harm may have gone beyond human life scale anyway. But nevertheless, technical stuff we can contain. Life, we can't. And it takes unintended consequences and ways that were not predicted. I mean, who would have argued that the cow is now ruling humans and the world through their need for feed, for which we have developed agriculture and for which we are destroying the planet? Is the cow ruling the world? Are we ruling the world? But that's just a bold example. If you go to microbes, once they are out, they're out. They can never be recalled. That is the way of evolution. It's probably highly unlikely that they will turn nasty. That comes more likely from the destruction of ecosystems. So, for example, COVID is a good example where climate change changes the distribution patterns of bats. These bats are then being put onto a unlicensed market. We eat them and thereby introduce viruses that we haven't been in contact with into humans. In the past, this has always happened when we came into contact with new animals, but we were not living a connected life where 747s from Wuhan every day land in Heathrow. In the past, a village might have been wiped out, but that's it. Nobody would have traveled. It wouldn't have turned into a global pandemic. So that's where I think the issue is, our connected world. And the other thing is, of course, if people as smart as Mike have ill intent, well, then we are done anyway. At the moment, I don't see that either.
I think we can all safely say that we really hope these emerging technologies continue to remain in the hands of well-intended individuals and organizations to create a better life for ourselves and for our environment. But at the same time, there has been this real estate market being created on emerging technologies and predictions. Agnieszka, I know this is something that you've been very interested in. Looking towards the future as an artist, how are you going to continue exploring these considerations in your own work?
So one of the questions that really interests me is how we are currently able to or trying to simulate and predict and sometimes even monetize and hedge on future states of nature. In a way, future became a form of real estate for sale, of course, because of the biotech industry. It's something that fascinates me, but of course, it's absolutely terrible. But I'm also interested in like the speculations, that the speculations create a market of this, like what it's going to look like. As I said before, even if the speculations are wrong, it doesn't matter because meanwhile, some people can draw profits from these speculations. Elizabeth Holmes is an example, and her imprisonment, of course. It's interesting to think about it in a broader sense, right? That currently people are making the speculations about the future and they can draw profits from it. For her, it ended really badly, but there are many other people that are doing maybe not at that scale, but are also around some kind of phantom entities, things that will never come true. There are companies that are speculating about life on other planets, hedging about mining asteroids for different elements. You know, interestingly enough, my work Airrights, which is a floating meteorite, was used in an article in the Süddeutsche Zeitung about 3 years ago because they lacked a visual. It was an article about future industries and the market of speculations about mining extraterrestrial like comets and asteroids. There is already a system of hedging upon these future industries, although the industries themselves do not exist. And I think that it's a lot of similar phenomena can be seen with biology. And of course, biotech is a field that is a lot of speculation and people are already thinking ahead. This really interests me in my work. So, you know, currently I'm working on a big exhibition at Mudam Luxembourg, where I'm exploring the question of risk landscapes. So how, you know, people are hedging on risks on the futures that might or might not happen, but meanwhile can be calculated and sold as a piece of real estate. So this question is really interesting in relationship to developments in biology and biotech.
As with every emerging technology, the question around funding and the interests that are driving it always arises. Agnieszka, as you've rightly highlighted in your previous answer, kind of looking towards the future of synthetic biologies. Mike, I'd like to ask you the final question of where do you see this field going and what interests are driving it? Is it academia, the government, or corporate interests?
I think it's all of those because as serious as the issue of unexpected consequences is, this is what we have now. So before we do anything new, we already have massive unexpected consequences because we are not good at predicting future behaviors, not just of complex systems, but of actually protocognitive systems. We already, both in medicine and environment, in all sorts of aspects of society, industry, and so on, we are rife with unexpected consequences. And so the development of a science to be able to guess in advance what level of competencies and what goals are going to be manifest from various types of complex systems, it's an existential problem for mankind going forward. It's required for us to flourish in the coming decades. So I think that the massive unmet needs of prediction and management of obviously environment, but biomedically, technologically, I think it's very clear to everybody that the status quo is highly problematic and incredibly hard to predict and manage already. There is no version of this where we don't do any new things and then everything stays predictable. Things are already not predictable. We see input from obviously government and academia, but industry is absolutely on top of this as well.
Thanks for listening to Talking Culture, a Futures podcast, a production of the Goethe Institute, London. Special thanks to the curator of this episode, Lucy Rose Sollett, and our guests, Mike Levin, Agnieszka Kuren, and Johannes Forgel. If you are interested in reading more about the topics discussed, you can visit our Synthetic Sacred webpage at goethe.de/UK/synthetic-sacred. There you can find a variety of materials shared by our guests from today's episode. Next month, for episode 20, we'll be exploring synthetic life, but through a more anthropological lens. we'll be discussing the psychedelic renaissance and indigenous perspectives with artist Annika Yee and Professor Keith Williams. The Goethe Institute is the cultural institute of Germany. We foster international cultural exchange and enable cultural involvement in over 100 countries worldwide. In London, we offer German language courses, cultural programs, events, literature, and much more, both in our institute on Exhibition Road and online. You can find out more on our website at goethe.de/London. I've been your producer and host, Lucy Rowan.